In verse 10, where the Bible says, again, Esther spake unto Hadok and gave him commandment unto Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's province do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come into the king, into the inner court, who is not called, there is one law of his to put him to death, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter, that he may live. But I have not been called to come in unto the king these 30 days. And they told to Mordecai Esther's words. Then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Then Esther bade them return to Mordecai this answer. Go gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan, and fast ye for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. I also and my maidens will fast likewise, and so will I go in unto the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish. And Mordecai went his way, and did according to all that Esther had commanded him. Jesus spoke of the difficult times that he saw on the horizon to come to Jerusalem. And he said concerning those times that men's hearts would fail them for fear. That in the time to come that men's hearts would fail them for fear. And I think that that is very much where we find ourselves facing the uncertainties of the year. We can read our papers and we can listen and see that in the world is much uncertainty, and it's an accurate description of many people in the world. Their heart is failing them for fear. Now, this book of Esther that we're going to study just for a little while this morning, I think if we study it and if we understand the underlying message of this book, that we as believers will have a greater assurance. I do not think it right that I think you would agree with me, that believers should not be in the same uncertainty as the world. We should not have the same fears, the same anxieties. I know that we go through the same type of situations, but there's something altogether different between the world and us. And it has to do with what we believe in our faith. And so a book like Esther is a book that assures believers that all is in the hands of God. That's the assurance that this book brings us to, is that everything is in the hands of God. This book never mentions the name of God. It's one of two books in the Bible that never mention the name of God, the Song of Solomon being the other. But this book is a declaration that God reigns in the affairs of men. It is a declaration through narrative, through a story that's given to us. This story is part of the history of the nation of the Jews, the people of the Jews. It's part of the history of the people while they were in exile. They had been taken captive and exiled from Jerusalem and dispersed. And during this period of time, Jerusalem lies destroyed and the temple, and the people are out there, and the Medes, the Persians are ruling them, and God's still in charge, and they're still in his hands. And this book shows us that. There's a great doctrine that's in this book, a great doctrine that we all should understand or we should lay hold of. And it's simply the doctrine of the providence of God. The theologians speak of the providence of God. And it's important that all of us understand this, that this is what we believe, that you and I are not living in a world that's merely full of chaos, but we're living in a world that indeed God is there, and God is very active, and God is accomplishing his purpose. The idea of providence is this. The definition of providence is that And it's given in the Westminster Catechism, their question 11. And the providence is defined as God's work. God's works of providence are his most holy, wise, and powerful, preserving and governing of all his creatures and all their actions. When, by providence, then, we mean that God is preserving and governing, that God is doing this to all in relationship to all of his creatures and relationship to all of their actions. A holy and wise and powerful God is governing, and he is preserving. Now, that's a little difficult to lay hold of in a world in which we live, and to see everything with, that we do see. And yet it is the teaching of the Bible. It is the assurance that we are to have as believers that a holy and wise and powerful God is preserving and governing all of his creatures and their actions. Underlying the idea of providence is this. It is the belief that God has a master plan. That God, in creating the world, had a master plan, and he continues to have a master plan. That God made Adam and Eve foreseeing everything that would happen. God knows the end from the beginning. There's nothing that God doesn't know. There's nothing that God ever learns. He knows our thoughts at the present. He knows our thoughts yesterday. But he knows what our thoughts will be tomorrow. And I know that that very thought that's an enormous thought. It's a very difficult thing to comprehend. That God knows my thoughts before they happen. He knows my words before they're spoken. He knows the very end from the beginning. He knows everything. And that God created man knowing everything would happen, and in doing so, he had a purpose, he had a plan, he had reason. That God had reason for what he was doing. And so he has a master plan. He is guiding history. That's the point. When you think of the providence of God, God is guiding history to accomplish his purposes. Now, not only does providence then show us that there is a master plan or teach us this, but it teaches us that God is active, not passive, in accomplishing his purposes. That God is active. Now, some of our forefathers believed in God, but they did not believe God was active. And many Christians today, if you really reduce what they believe and practice down, they believe God in God, but they don't tend to live as though he were active. They tend to think it's just passive. We referred Wednesday night to the idea of the laws of the universe and the question whether this world is governed by laws or is it governed by God? Or we may say God uses laws, but I think there's cause in the Bible to believe and to realize that the world is more than laws. The world is operating by more than laws. That God is active in this thing. We are not deists. We don't merely believe that God created the world and set it in motion and he's out there. But as we understand the Bible, God has a divine plan, and he's very active in history, in the present, in working in people's lives to accomplish his purposes. That you don't see God, but if you can look, you'll see his hand. And I dare say that every believer in this room, if you think about it, And you look back over the course of your life. While you may not have known it at the time, you know it now looking back, that God was directing your life. Even maybe just what seemed like incidental at the time, somebody spoke to you. And that incidental thing directed the course of your life that led to a chain of events that have brought you here. Maybe it was a crisis in your life. You look back and you say, at this particular point in my life or my family's life, there was a tremendous crisis. And that crisis has brought my family to where it is today. And you can look back and you see different things moving. I like to do that in my own spiritual life. I like to look back at the journey of my spiritual life. You know, I've been in this journey now for 34 years or more. And some things were crises. I mean, some things I look back and it was like a thunderbolt. Something big happened in my life and affected years to come. But then some things seem so incidental, so small. And yet, those small things directed my life in unbelievable ways. Sometimes it was just a conversation. Sometimes it was just meeting a person I never met before. And you can look back at your spiritual journey and see. It's interesting to look back at how you came to Christ. How were you brought to faith in Christ? Now, for many of us, we were raised in a Christian family. We were taught in the Sunday school. We were taught in the church. But go beyond that. If that's your history, go beyond that and try to find the spiritual history of your family. Find the spiritual heritage that you have. What guided the ship? What has led you to where you are? That's what we mean by providence, that there is this God who's very active, who's accomplishing his purposes, and he does it in amazing ways. You take your Bible with me to the Psalms. I want to give you some verses. I'd like to give you a lot of verses. But I know we can't do that. I read to you Psalm 75 at the opening, where that verse tells us that God raises up people. And it's talking about leadership, that God raises up leaders. And we find that same truth in Romans 13, that God raises up governing authorities. We find that same truth in the life of Pharaoh, where God says, I raised you up for this. I raised Pharaoh up. But in Psalm 103, I'm just going to give you a number of verses, and you might jot them down, mark them down, just before we come to look at the book of Esther. Psalm 103 and verse 19. The Lord hath prepared his throne in the heavens, and his kingdom ruleth over all. That's the whole doctrine of providence, that God's kingdom rules over all. Now look at Psalm 104 right next to it. We could read the whole psalm, but look at verse 14. He causeth the grass to grow for the cattle. He causes this. The herb for the service of man, that he may bring forth food out of the earth, the wine that maketh glad the heart of man, and oil to make his face to shine, and bread which strengtheneth man's heart. He says God causes these things to happen. God causes all of the growth of the crops that take place. Look at verse 21. The young lions roar after their prey and seek their meat from who? From God. Then look at verse 27. These wait all upon thee, that thou mayest give them their meat in due season. That thou givest them, they gather. that thou givest them, they gather. Thou openest thine hand, and they are filled with good. Thou hidest thy face, they are troubled. Thou takest away the breath, their breath, they die. In other words, you control their food, and you control when they die, and return to the dust. Thou sendest forth thy spirit, they are created. Thou renewest the face of the earth. The glory of the Lord shall endure forever. The Lord shall rejoice in his works. He looketh on the earth, and it trembleth. He touches the hills, and they smoke. You think of the smoky mountains, but think of the volcanoes. He's saying that God does all this. He sends forth his breath, and they are created. I think there's plenty of evidence in the Bible to this, that every child that's ever born is born as a direct act of God. Psalm 127, Psalm 128. Now, think about that. Every child, a direct act of God. That's what the Bible is teaching us about a very, very active God. Look at Psalm 66. Verse 7. He ruleth by his power forever. His eyes behold the nations. Let not the rebellious exalt themselves. Notice verse 9. Which holdeth our soul in life, and suffereth not our feet to be moved. And verse 12. Thou hast caused men to ride over our heads. We went through fire and through water, and thou broughtest us out into a wealthy place. The psalmist is declaring that God, that his very life is in the hands of God, and that he rules over all. And they're going through trial as a result of God bringing it about in their life. They're going through the fire and through the waters. They're going through difficulties. And the psalmist is saying that we're going through these difficulties because God. God is doing so. That's the teaching of the Bible. Look at chapter 31. Verse 15. My times are in thy hand. My life's in your hand. My time's in your hands. Deliver me from the hand of mine enemies and from them that persecute me. What is he doing there? He's praying. Why does a man pray? Have you ever thought at the basis of prayer is the belief that God is active? At the basis of prayer is the belief that God is not just off in the heavens, detached from our lives. The very fact that you pray means that you believe that God is an active God. Well, so many verses all the way through. Turn to Job. I have to pick and choose what we go to because of time. Time does not allow us to take all of the scriptures in for sure. In Job chapter 9, verse 5. Talk about the Lord, which moveth the mountains, and they know not, which overturneth them in his anger, which shaketh the earth out of her place, and the pillars thereof tremble, which commandeth the sun. Notice this, and it riseth not. We say, well, everything's governed by laws. No, this tells us it's governed by God. He sealeth up the stars. Look at chapter 12 of Job. Verse 10, in whose hand is the soul of every living thing, and the breath of all mankind? Verse 23, he increases the nations and destroys them. He enlarges the nations and straightens them again. He taketh away the heart of the chief of the people of the earth, and causeth them to wander in the wilderness where there is no way. Then look at chapter 37. Verse 10. By the breath of God, frost is given, and the breadth of the waters is made narrow or straightened. Chapter 38, verse 12. Hast thou commanded the morning since thy days, and caused the day spring to know its place? He commands the mornings, the sunrise. Look at verse 35. Canst thou send lightnings that they may go and say unto thee, here we are? What God is asking Job, can you do this? And what he's saying is, I do that. Where does the wind come from? Why does the wind blow? You can't see the wind, but you know it's there. And men try to now assign causes, but the Bible tells us. Where does the frost come from? Where does the lightning come from? And you may assign all of the laws to these things. But what the Bible teaches us is that God is behind them all. Read Proverbs 21, verse 1. The heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord. As the rivers of water, he turns it wherever he wants to. Wherever he wills, he turns the heart of kings. Read 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13. There's no temptation taking you but what is common to man. But God is faithful. With every temptation, he will make a way of escape. He does that. He's active. Romans 8:28. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them that are called according to his purpose. And literally that verse means and reads this way. That God is working all things together. It isn't merely that all things work out. It isn't this fatalism. Well, everything will be okay in the end. That isn't what Romans 8:28 is saying. What Romans 8:28 is saying is that God is working in everything to accomplish his purpose for our good. That's the great teaching of the Bible. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 26. And Jesus talks about the feeding of the sparrows. In that chapter, he talks about the clothing of the lilies of the field. One other passage, and it's to be found in Paul's sermon to Athens. And it's the 17th chapter of the book of Acts, verse 25. So speaking of God who made the world, in verse 24, and all things therein. Neither is worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything. Notice this. Seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things. And he hath made of one blood all nations of men, for to dwell on all the face of the earth. Listen to this. And hath determined the times before appointed, and the bounds of their habitation. God is doing this. Man feels like he's in charge. He feels like he's in control. But what the Bible tells us is that God is in control. That man can make decisions, but God is working his plan. God is accomplishing his purpose. Now go back to the book of Esther. In the book of Esther, we have this narrative. It's a narrative about a plot to kill the Jews. We find this taking place in the third chapter. There's this man named Haman in verse 6. It says along about the middle of the verse that Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout all the kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. And he goes to the king and he gets permission to kill all of the Jews on a particular day. As a result of this, the Jews are in mourning. Look at chapter 4. When Mordecai perceived all that was done, Mordecai rent his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city and cried with a loud and bitter cry, and came even before the king's gate, for none might enter into the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. And in every province, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, there was great mourning among the Jews, and fasting and weeping and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. Now that's the underlying plot of the book of Esther. This man Haman, he hates Mordecai. Mordecai is a Jew. And because he hates Mordecai, he determines to not only kill Mordecai, but to kill all of the Jews. And because he is so strong in the king's favor, he goes to the king and the king gives him permission to kill all of these people. And that plot underlies this book. When we talk about the providence of God, it begins right there. Because, you see, here in the third chapter, he lays this plot. Here in this third chapter, he forms these laws. And the fourth chapter, these Jews are weeping bitterly. You can imagine, they know they're going to die. They've already been taken captive. What's to keep them from dying? But if you read this book, you realize a couple things have already happened. The book is called Esther. In the second chapter, Esther becomes queen. In the first chapter, Vashti is removed from being queen. In the second chapter, Esther becomes queen. Who is Esther? If you read this book, you're going to find this is true, that Esther is a Jew. The king doesn't know she's a Jew. Haman doesn't know she's a Jew. But she's a cousin to Mordecai. Mordecai's raised her. And in the search for a new queen, Esther is brought to the king's palace. And you find in verse 9 of chapter 2 and verse 15 of chapter 2 and verse 17 of chapter 2, she continually finds favor. She finds favor with all and finally with the king. And she's made queen over all the land. That's the first work of providence. Before this plot ever takes place, God's placed Esther as queen. The second thing that happens is found in the second chapter. There's a plot to kill the king. And notice in verse 21 about this in chapter 2. In those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, were wroth, and sought to lay hand on the king Ahasuerus. And the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it unto Esther the queen, and Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. Excuse me. And when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore they were both hanged on a tree, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. This is the second act of providence. The first is the queen, Esther becomes queen. The second, Mordecai saves the king's life. He overhears this plot. He informs Esther. She informs the king. It's written in the Chronicles of the king in Mordecai's name. And so the saving of the king. And so then you come to the plot. That's the third chapter. And you come then to the fourth chapter, to our text. Because the Jews, they're sentenced to die. Mordecai, fasting, sackcloth and ashes, he sends word to Esther about what's about to happen, to go to the king. She says, I can't go to the king. If I try to go to the king and he doesn't hold out a golden scepter, there's but one law, and that's death. And Mordecai comes back to her and sends the message and says, listen, don't think that you will escape being in the palace. You're a Jew. All the Jews are going to be killed. And then he said to her those words in the fourth chapter in verse 14. Who knows but what you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. In other words, Mordecai teaches her about providence. Mordecai tells her, think about this, Esther. Consider that you've been made queen. Here you are, a Jew, and you're queen. Now think about it. Maybe the very reason you're the queen is because of this right here. Maybe God has taken you from nowhere and placed you in this position, and God's going to use you to save the Jews. In other words, he's trying to teach her providence. As she listens, and she says, I tell you what to do. Go and fast for me for 3 days, day and night. By the way, fasting in the Bible, if you want to understand a little bit about fasting, you should never just fast on schedule. You should never just say, maybe like a young person, a preacher might say, well, I'm going to fast 3 days a week. And so that becomes your schedule. That isn't about fasting in the Bible is about a particular need. Fasting in the Bible is about a crisis. That's when people fasted. They realized a great need. Maybe they realized a need for deliverance in war, in famine. Or maybe they realized the need for spiritual power. And it is in your life, sometimes there are crises. And you give yourself to a period of fasting and praying to seek God for that. That's what we find these people doing. They're fasting 3 days and three nights. And she says, if I perish, I perish. I'm going to the king. The fifth chapter, she does that. She goes into the king and he holds out the golden scepter. And she says to the king, he says, I want you and Haman to come to a banquet. Well, they come before her and she says, the king says, what do you want now? She says, I want you to come back tomorrow. Come back tomorrow, I'm going to have this banquet. Haman goes home, and on his way home, he passes Mordecai. He hates Mordecai. Mordecai won't bow. Mordecai says, I'm a Jew. I don't bow to Gentiles. I don't bow to people. I bow to God. Haman so hates him, he goes home, and he tells his family, he gathers all of them together. He says, I want to tell you about the good fortune that's happened to me. The favor that the king has to me. And would you believe Queen Esther? She's having a banquet and she doesn't want anybody else to come but me. Me and the king. But he said, as long as I have to see Mordecai alive, I can't enjoy it. And his family and friends said, well, why don't you make some gallows and hang old Mordecai? Ask the king in the morning to hang Mordecai. And so that's a good idea. And he made gallows 75 foot high. That is a place to hang somebody. The next morning early, he rises and he goes to see the king. But something has happened during the night. And you can read this in the sixth chapter. In the middle of the night, the king cannot sleep. He can't sleep. And he calls for the reading of the Chronicles of the Kings. Now, if you want to go to sleep, get a history book out. How many of you ever stayed awake when a history teacher was talking? I think history is one of the most interesting subjects that's ever been, and yet I very seldom in my life have found anybody that can teach it but what I don't sleep. In fact, I in college, when I was taking ancient history, was sure at times the professor himself was going to sleep while he was talking. It was that dull at times, and I hope you would never hear about that. But that's history. You want to read history and interesting, get you good biographies. That'll give you a good history. But he calls for the reading of the Chronicles of the King, and lo and behold, as he's listening, they read about Mordecai sparing his life. That happened in the second chapter. And he says, what's been done for Mordecai? He spared my life. He saved my life. He related the enemy's plot. They said, nothing's been done. At this very moment, Haman comes to the door, ready to ask that Mordecai be hung. Instead, the king says, what should be done for the man that the king wants to honor? And Haman said, well, who would the king want to honor but me? And he says, I'll tell you, take the king's horse and take the king's garment and take all the garments, the things that the king wears in honor, and put them on that man and let the chief noble of the king's people lead that man through his horse, on the king's horse through the city, and let him cry out. This is the man. This is what happens to the man whom the king desires to honor. Haman said all of that with the intention, with thought, it's going to be me. But that isn't what happens. The king says, that's a good idea. That's what I want done. Do everything you said. Go get Mordecai, dress him up, put him on that horse, and through the town lead him. And that's what takes place. Haman is grieved in his heart and runs home. Afterward, and his family and friends, he tells them what happened. And they tell him, you're going to fall. And sure enough, he does. He goes back to the banquet that night, and it's in the banquet that Esther confronts him and says to the king, says, someone has plotted to kill all of my people. And he says, who? And she sticks her finger out and points at Haman, says, this wicked Haman. As a result of that, the king says, take him and hang him on the gallows that he's prepared for Mordecai. All of this you can read in this narrative. And as you read on, there's another decree that's signed, giving the Jews the right to defend themselves. And if you read on, then Mordecai is giving all that was Haman's. Mordecai now stands in Haman's position, having all that was Haman's. And as you read on, there's a great celebration. There's great rejoicing. Many, in fact, the Bible says in the 8th chapter, 17th verse, that many of the Persians, they become Jews. They convert. There's celebration. Their sorrow is turned to joy. All of this in the 9th chapter, in the 8th chapter. You can read it all there. And in this whole story that never mentions the name of God, you see the sovereign hand of God. You see God governing and ruling. Before the plot ever takes place, the queen is in her position. Before the plot ever takes place, Mordecai's name is in the history books. And as this plot is taking place, the king can't sleep and is reminded about what Mordecai had done for him. And there's wicked Haman, who's made gallows for Mordecai. He's hanging on his own gallows. And later his 10 sons are hung too. All of this is the providence of God. So by providence, we mean that God is active. That God has a master plan. He has a master plan for these Jews. You know what that master plan is, don't you? These Jews were in exile, that's right. And these Jews were under judgment, that's right. But God was still going to use these Jewish people to bring his son into the world. His son was a Jew. God was not going to allow these Jews to be exterminated. God was not going to allow Haman to destroy them. And so God was active, raises up a queen, saves a king's life, keeps a king from sleeping. All of these things, God is actively working. And what looked like a very sad moment became a very joyful moment. The people are weeping. Mordecai is weeping. The people are fasting. They're just tore up for every province. But read the 9th chapter and read the 10th chapter. The story wasn't over, you see. Haman hangs. His sons hang. Mordecai is now second to the king. The Jews create... they have a special feast from then on as a result of this. And many people converted. Talking about the providence of God in life. That God works in everything. Our lives are in his hands. That God works. He feeds the lions. He causes the grass to grow. He causes the sun to rise. He sends the lightning. He blows with his breath and the frost comes. He allows enemies to be raised up that he might take them down. He takes people that are down and lifts them up. He places a man almost overnight where a man with all of his ambitions could have never got. Second in command in the kingdom. That's the providence of God. What looks bad may very well be good. I want to talk to you about living in the providence of God just for a minute. And tell you, as a believer, God has a master plan for your life. His church. He has a master plan for his church. That's true throughout the world, and that's true in a local church that follows him. He has his plan. He works in providence. What you think looks bad may call you to pray and may call you to fast, and that's good. Some of your worst days caused you to seek God, and you found him. But the bad turned out to be very good. And God allows it all for his glory. He allows us to walk through the fire, and he allows us to go through the flood. Think about what happened, the celebration. The sorrow turned to joy. The people that are converted. None of that would have happened. People are just living their lives, day by day going on. They're in exile. It's almost as if they had forgotten God. But God allowed all this to happen, and God worked in all of it to accomplish his purpose. Look at Esther. As she understands the doctrine of providence, she overcomes her fear. She says, if I perish, I perish. Here we are. We're living in God's purpose. We're living and he's active in our life. Does that mean we're passive? No, we're not passive. And these people were not passive. You see them fasting. You see them praying. You see them, although God's not mentioned, you can see them seeking. They weren't passive. I always love what Oswald Chambers said. He said that we should trust God and do the next thing that we know to do. That's a pretty good rule to live by. Trust God and do the next thing you know to do. Just keep doing the next thing. Keep doing the next right thing. But keep trusting him. Hudson Taylor, his idea was this: move men through God by prayer alone. He was never out asking for money. He wasn't asking for missionaries. He kept asking God for missionaries and support. His idea was to move men to give and move men to go through God by prayer alone. You see, that's not passive. You and I are not passive. We're not just sitting still. We're praying people. We're obeying people. But as we pray and as we obey, we go through this life with a calm assurance that it's bigger than us. That there's an unseen hand that's guiding us. That sometimes he takes us through the fire. And sometimes he takes us through the waters. As I read to you a while ago, but he brings us out to a wealthy place. He brings us out to a good place. It's his providential hand. You and I are called to live by faith, to trust him, to trust God in the dark, to go on, to do what's right, to know that God is in control, to believe that. That he can turn the tables in our life. We may see our enemies. The things that we were afraid of. On the gallows. Or brought down. Or destroyed. But the point is, we have to trust God. We have to rest in him. We have to at times wait on him. We don't see him always in the moment. We can't see him where he's going. But can't you do this? Can't you look behind you? Can't you look back as your ship has been on the waters of life? And you see that ship coming through these waters of life. And you can see a clear pattern. You can see clear direction. I remember Brother Crocker talking about evangelism. I never forgot his illustration of evangelism. He said it's like a pinball machine. And some of you know what that is. And I hope all do for the sake of illustration. It's a little steel ball that there's a pinball machine and there's arms that are knocking the thing all around. And the ball hits off one thing, hits off another, and hits off another. And finally, you know, it accomplishes what you want. He said, that's how evangelism works. He said, here, we're like the lost man's like the little ball, and somebody hits him over here with a word and goes over here, and somebody will say something, and somebody will say something, and somebody, and all through, you can't see, but it's just one thing after another touching this person's life. And then finally, the ball's in the goal. You say, who won the person? You can't really say, can you? Somebody spoke to him up here, and somebody spoke to him over here, and someone over here. Now, I take that illustration to life. You're very much where you are today in your life because God used something here, and He used something here, and He used something here, and something over here. But He was always directing your life. Sometimes it was a mountain of joy that you were experiencing. Sometimes it's a valley of despair. But understand this, there's the unseen hand that's guiding your life. That's why I say a believer doesn't approach this year like the unbeliever. We're not all caught up in the economy. I know we're human and we see it. But we also see that our lives are in His hands. Isn't that what He said? Our lives are in His hands. And He is working in all things. It is God that worketh in you to will and to do of His good pleasure. And in all things God is working to work everything together to accomplish His purpose. He's there. And it may be a salvation of a loved one that's going to take place. It may be that God is refining you. You and I, we don't see the rough places in our life. We don't see the pride that keeps God from blessing us. We don't see what others see sometimes, and they wish we would see. But God sees it. And so He takes us to accomplish His purpose. But He's always working. So I want to ask you to do this. To look for God's hand in your life. To ask the question, what is God doing in these circumstances? Not being passive. Not just set and stoically just accept what comes. But actively pray and let your crisis cause you to fast. And seek God. But always look for His hand. Somebody comes into your life. Why has that person come into my life? Somebody says a word that you can't get away from. Has that word come from that to that person from God, from me? I know in my own life, just a word has directed my ship. Just a word. And a friendship. And a darkness. What seemed bad has been good. And I will tell you this, what sometimes has seemed good turned out to be bad. But then again, even that was in the hand of God. And it taught me not to trust in fair weather. Not to be deceived by fair winds. but to understand your life is in His hands. Now, think about your life. You're looking for God's hand in it. Where is your life right now? I want to ask you, what has God put in your hands? What has God put in your life? What's God doing in you? See, here you are. Where's your situation? I don't know. There's a lot of us in this room. But do you see your life as part of that master working? If you do, then look at yourself and ask, what's God doing? What's He doing now? What's the unseen hand of God? Why has He done this? Why has He done this? We could stand now and testify of the providence of God. I love this doctrine. I think it's one of the doctrines I love so much. What seems so little at the time turned out to be so big. And what seems so big has often turned out to be so little. But always in His hands. His hands. Let's stand together.